Good afternoon. In case you're forgetting who I am, Mark Oppold, RFD-TV Rural Radio from Nashville, Tennessee. The hours are getting shorter for the my administration. It's a great afternoon. Hopefully it's been a profitable day for everyone and a profitable week here at our convention. And what a way for us to end our convention this year as we host the Honorable Tom Vilsack, United States Secretary of Agriculture, here to share an hour with us. We will, the Secretary will make some opening remarks and would rather field questions from you broadcasters. That's the way the setup is. Mr. Secretary, before I give your formal introduction, I want to say publicly on behalf of all the broadcasters who are here how much we appreciate your staff at USDA, even through the shutdown days, but moreover, during normal business days, that you and your staff are always available, responsive to our broadcasters. We can get the word out through the help of your capable staff in Washington, D.C. So thank you very much on behalf of the NAFB for that staff. We've enjoyed having you at RFD-TV several times. So. Well, I'm going to read part of this because it's important to know in case anyone would ask. Secretary Vilsack is the nation's 30th Secretary of Agriculture, leading the U.S. Department of Agriculture to strengthen rural America, the economy, vibrant rural communities, creating new markets and opportunities and innovations for young America as well. And with that, let's welcome an NAFB welcome, the Honorable Tom Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark. I mean, if this crowd doesn't know who I am, I'm in deep trouble. Well, thank you very much. And we really do appreciate what RFD-TV and radio is doing and what all of you folks are doing. I want to start off by acknowledging the good work that you all do. Part of the frustrating aspect of this job is that so many of the media folks do not understand or appreciate what goes on the farm, on the ranch, in fields, and in rural areas. And it is important and necessary for not just folks in rural America to understand the important work that's done in small towns and on those farms and ranches, but all of America to appreciate. And the fact that you all are engaged in getting the word out about the importance of agriculture, the importance of what folks in rural communities do for the country, is often not appreciated, and it needs to be. So first and foremost, I want to say thank you for what you all do. It's important work, and I'm really pleased Mark was sharing with me that the Broadcasters Association has grown in size. I'm now told that you have 168 members. And I'm particularly interested in noting that there are a number of young people who are now engaged in as members, student members, and interns. I think that's great. And now you've got 67 or 68 young people who are interested in following in your footsteps, which is terrific. And the fact that you're making that opportunity available to these young people is important because they've got to carry the message on. And I know that you had a great panel of commissioners and directors of agriculture and secretaries. Of course, my favorite state ag secretary is Karen Ross from California. It's not just because she's from California, the number one state in agriculture. I'm sure she reminded all of you of that. But as you probably know, Karen was a chief of staff for me for a while and certainly appreciated the job that she did at USDA. So it's good to see my good friend and my favorite ag secretary here today. And I know that Commissioner Strand is, from Louisiana was here, and Mr. Goring from North Dakota. My heart goes out to the folks in the Dakotas. What they've gone through in the last couple of months has not been easy. Director Ibach, who is from Nebraska, I was in Nebraska last week and certainly appreciated the time on the University of Nebraska campus. And Secretary Rodman from Kansas. So you had a great panel, and it's great that they were able to participate. I thought what I'd do is just focus really quickly on three announcements that have been made in the last 24 hours, and then talk a bit about the Farm Bill, and then open it up to questions. The first announcement was the export announcement, the fact that we have now reached a record level of agricultural exports. once again, $140.9 billion of exports. It's the best 5 years of ag exports in the history of the country. If you compare it to the previous five-year period, we've done $230 billion more of agricultural exports, and our volume is up as well. On average, nearly 4 million tons more per year is being exported throughout the world. Speaks very highly of the work that's being done in export promotion. We're aggressively, obviously, focused on that. Every dollar we spend at USDA invested in ag promotion nets about $35 in trade activity. I'm certainly pleased with the work that folks do throughout the world on behalf of American agriculture, breaking down trade barriers. Over the last 4.5 years, we've knocked down 1,298 efforts by the international community to make it a little bit harder for our ag goods to get into the stream of commerce, but we've knocked them down and it's opened up markets. And, of course, we're very much engaged in free trade agreement negotiations and discussions, opening up a couple of free trade agreements a year or so ago, but now focused on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the EU free trade agreements. Tough negotiations ahead, but very important. And the President is seeking from Congress fast-track authority so we can get those free trade agreements once they're negotiated through the process. Some difficult issues on agriculture and those trade agreements, but we're going to work through those issues and hopefully open up an enormous opportunity for us in the Southeast Asia, hundreds of millions of new customers that can take full advantage of the great quality and quantity that we're able to produce in the United States. So that's one announcement. The second announcement was one that we made this morning, which was the establishment of the National Drought Resiliency Partnership. I don't know if Colleen Callahan is still here or not, but Colleen, there she is. Colleen, I want to thank you for the work that you did on the Drought Task Force. As you know, we yanked her from Illinois, brought her to Washington, D.C., and asked her to do a small favor for us, which was to run our drought mitigation task force efforts, and what a great job she did. And part of that was an opportunity for us to travel around the country and listen to folks and producers in particular as to what we could do better, what we could do more, what we could do differently. And one of the things that came out of those discussions was the need for us to be more proactive in the face of drought as opposed to being reactive, which you have to do, obviously, in the face of a drought. You've got to do things like open up CRP land and things of that nature, but how could we be more proactive? Nearly 32% of America's land mass today is still in drought condition. That's obviously down from where it was last year, but it's about 12% more than the normal. So we're still dealing with drought in a number of parts of the country. And this new partnership is a collaborative effort between the Department of Commerce and NOAA, the Department of Interior, the Department of Energy, the Army Corps of Engineers, EPA, FEMA, and the USDA to try to work collaboratively in an integrated and coordinated fashion to do a better job of responding and creating an opportunity for us to be a little better prepared and to mitigate the consequences of future droughts. What we hope to do in 2014 with this partnership is first and foremost create an initial point of contact, which obviously is of interest to broadcasters, I mean, and to local and state officials. I mean, if there is a drought, who do you call? Where do you go for help? If there's a tornado, if there's a flood, it's pretty simple. You pick up the phone, you call FEMA, because you know that's your point of contact. Well, we didn't have that. Various people got contacted. So this partnership will allow us to identify a single point of contact. And then we will create a clearinghouse for all the programs that are available that deal with the consequences of drought. The way it is today, you got to know what the EPA programs are. You got to know what the USDA programs are. There's no single place for you to go. Interior may have a few programs. The Army Corps may have a few programs. We're going to create a central location where all that information will become available. We're going to designate a vulnerable watershed in 2014, and we're going to focus on developing a pilot project in that vulnerable watershed that will allow us to learn how to make watersheds, how to make areas of the country more resilient to drought. What are the best management practices that we can institute? How can we get the word out and the information out to folks so that they can better defend against or protect against the onset of drought? And finally, what we hope to be able to do is to have a much better understanding of soil moisture, We've instituted a soil health campaign through NRCS, and now what we want to do is create better data about precisely what the condition of soil moisture is throughout the United States. This will allow us, I think, to do a better job of forecasting, a better job of modeling, a better job of understanding when we might be on the cusp of a drought so that folks can take proactive measures to mitigate the consequences. And this is in line with our efforts with climate change. We're establishing climate change hubs. I mentioned the soil health campaign. We have a watershed condition framework where we're focusing on quality and quantity of water at USDA, and of course our collaborative forest restoration project is also focused on making our forests more resilient, so this is an effort to be more proactive. And then the final announcement today did not come from USDA, it came from EPA in terms of the RFS. And I think what's important, I think all of you will focus, no doubt, in your reports on this, on the numbers, but I would invite you to also understand that there was an unprecedented set of comments in the EPA announcement today. And it's unprecedented because what EPA has done is it has essentially said, we are very interested in maintaining this industry, and we need information from the industry as to policies and programs in addition to the RFS that would allow this industry to be more sustainable and more profitable. So it's inviting, as part of the comment period on the numbers, also the industry to weigh in on what policies do we need to change, what policies do we need to adopt, what policies do we need to consider to make sure that this industry continues to be viable. At USDA, what we're going to focus on are those aspects of this industry that we can control. We established under our REAP program an opportunity for folks to gain financial assistance to build a larger distribution system within the United States so that higher blends of ethanol and biofuels can be accessed. The reality is we've got 8 to 9 million flexible fuel vehicles in this country, but hardly any of them can access higher blends because there just simply aren't the gas stations that sell it. And oftentimes, even if there are, some of the owners of those flexible fuel vehicles may not know or appreciate that they can use a higher blend. So we are going to continue to remind people of the fact that we have this program. We have a business and industry program that provides loan guarantees. And so I think our challenge is to work with the industry, and particularly the large-scale operators in this industry, the Cargills and the ADMs and others, to suggest to them that they need to work to create a distribution system, that they can't rely on the petroleum industry or the convenience store or petroleum marketers to do this. They've got to figure out a way to work around the oil industry because it's pretty clear the oil industry is not supportive of this industry. And they've done everything they can in the courts, in regulation, and in the legislation to try to impede the success of this industry. So we're going to be very focused on this distribution challenge, and we're going to encourage the private sector to weigh in, to work with us, because we are very interested in making sure we continue to get the benefits from this industry. The lower cost to consumers, the choice that consumers have, the jobs that are connected to it, and, of course, the more stable and secure incomes for producers. That's why we are investing in biorefineries. It's why we're continuing to work and excited about the drop in aviation fuel opportunities that we're engaged in four projects with the Navy and the Department of Energy. It's why we have regional hubs taking a look at feedstocks and the supply chain for those new feedstocks. They've got the Farm to Fly initiative with the commercial aviation industry. And we're, of course, providing assistance under BCAP and some of the other farm bill programs to try to get this industry to a good place. So these are announcements that we've made that have an impact, obviously, on producers. One announcement I wish I could make that I can't is I'd like to be able to say I'm here today to announce disaster assistance for livestock producers who suffered through a drought and those who've suffered through a serious set of snowstorms where their herds have been substantially damaged or they've incurred extraordinary expense to be able to feed their herds. I can't do that, as you know, because the livestock disaster programs expired on September 30th of 2011. They were not continued or extended by Congress when they extended the Farm Bill earlier this year. And, of course, now all Farm Bill programs have expired as of September 30th of this year. I think it's important for us to point out that the country, not just the rural parts, not just the farmers, not just the producers, but the country needs a farm bill. The country needs a farm bill. We obviously need the policy certainty that comes with a farm bill. And I've talked to a countless number of producers throughout the last couple of months. I've had a series of meetings with producers. And the one message that comes back repeatedly, regardless of what part of the country I'm in, is that they can't make decisions. They don't know what to do. They'd like to maybe extend. They'd like to maybe expand their operation. They'd like to go into a new operation. They'd like to buy a new piece of equipment. But they are hesitant to do that because they simply do not know what the programs are going to be or if there is going to be a program. And so it's important for us to get the certainty of policy so that these producers can continue to expand, continue to grow, continue to invest, because that ripples through the economy. And all Americans benefit, not just producers, from that certainty. It's important for farmers to have the safety net in place that will provide protection if Mother Nature doesn't cooperate, or if we're faced with a situation where prices precipitously decline through no fault of a producer. This benefits not just producers, and I think this is an important message that needs to be underscored. This notion of a farm safety net is often couched in a very narrow discussion of the importance to farmers. It's important to every American, and here's why. Farming's a risky business. You can be the best farmer in the world. You can do everything right, and you can end up with no crop through no fault of yours. If we don't have a safety net, if you don't have programs that reduce that risk to a manageable level, a lot of people are going to get out of the business. And when they get out of the business, what that will mean is that the nation, which is currently a food secure nation, a nation that's capable of producing and, in fact, does produce virtually all that we need to feed ourselves, is no longer a food-secure nation. We're no longer as strong or as safe when we are no longer a food-secure nation. So that farm safety net is really about reducing the risk to encourage people to stay in the business and to continue to be in the business and want to be in the business. So all Americans benefit from that safety net. All of America needs a farm bill because it's a reform bill. We're all concerned about the deficit. We all know we've got to get our fiscal house in order. And it's very difficult for Congress to make decisions about what to cut because every single program has a constituency that feels strongly about their program. I was talking to Courtney Rowe, who's in my communication shop. You all know her. She's here today. And the irony is that in Washington, D.C., everything is siloed. And, of course, we like silos at the Department of Agriculture, but we don't like these silos because everyone is defensive of their little siloed area. And there doesn't seem to be, with the exception of the Department of Agriculture, where we basically have our hands and fingers in virtually everything that goes on, from food production to job growth to research to universities. I mean, we have a broad portfolio. So we have to take a broader approach and a broader view. And we know, and we have already contributed deficit reduction in order to get our fiscal house in order. Well, one area where we might be able to save a little money, reduce that deficit, become a little fiscally more responsible, is with a farm bill. And when we become more fiscally responsible, we keep those interest rates down, and that benefits all Americans. Americans who want to buy a house, buy a car, credit card, all of that benefits Americans. All Americans benefit from conservation programs. I mean, we all want and need nutritious soil. We all want and need adequate quantities and better quality of water. And when you consider nearly half of the landmass of the United States is involved in forestry or farming or ranching, you realize that we have an impact through our conservation programs on the very essence of life. So all Americans benefit and will benefit from a streamlined conservation set of programs that this new farm bill potentially could have. All Americans benefit from what we do when we expand market opportunities, whether it's in export markets or whether it's a local and regional food system or whether it's a bio-based manufacturing facility that takes a waste product and produces a chemical or a fuel or an energy supply. It creates jobs. And the more jobs we have in the economy, the stronger our economy is, the less the deficit is, the stronger the nation is. So the point of all of this is that America needs this farm bill. It's not just rural America, not just farmers, not just ranchers. It's all of America. And certainly we need to be an innovative nation. You cannot be an innovative nation unless you have investment in research. And certainly this bill would provide additional opportunities for research in our great land-grant universities. It would create a research foundation. So it's an innovation bill. And, of course, it creates jobs in those university towns. And it creates new ways to do business so that we continue to be this extraordinary productivity in agriculture. It's an amazing story that agriculture is the second most productive aspect of our economy since 1980. I see Larry Quinn here. Larry, it's good to see you again. Larry was around in 1980. Well, maybe it was 18. He's been around a long time, and so he knows what I'm talking about. It has been an amazing story of productivity, and it's underappreciated by the rest of the country, that farming and agriculture has allowed us really in almost a lifetime to go from farming that was subsistence and just barely getting by to this extraordinary engine that not only provides us this great diversity of food, but because of the efficiencies, it also allows us to have the most affordable food in the world. But you can't have any of that unless you continue to research, and unless you figure out ways to adapt and mitigate to a changing climate, for example, and the risks that are associated with that. So it's important that we have a farm bill for all Americans. Just the last couple of points. It's also important for all of America to have a nutrition assistance program that works. And unfortunately, the focus has been on numbers. People say, Mr. Secretary, is it $4 billion or is it $40 billion? What's the number? It's not about the number. It's about the right policy. You get the right policy, it'll give you a number. And the right policy is ensuring that we do a better job of creating work opportunities within a general economy, and we do a better job of linking those work opportunities with people who are on SNAP. Now, frankly, I don't think the House has the right formula for doing that. They just want to unilaterally whack away and create requirements that, under the circumstances, don't really make a lot of sense. Let me make this point. 92% of SNAP beneficiaries are either in the workforce already, children, people with serious disabilities, or senior citizens. So when you start talking about work requirements, it's important for people to understand that doesn't apply to 100% of the SNAP beneficiaries. It conceptually applies only to 8%. And that 8% currently has a work requirement. The law basically says that if you are an able-bodied person without a dependent and you're not in the workforce, you are limited to 3 months of SNAP assistance every 36 months. So 3 months every 3 years. Now, that condition can be waived at the state level. Not at the federal level, at the state level. Governors can make the decision, legislatures can make the decision that, you know, the unemployment rate is so high or there was a plant closing in a county and that's distorted the unemployment numbers. And so they can say for a period of time, we're not going to apply that work requirement. But it's a state decision. So when folks talk about requiring work, it's already in the law. But here's what we ought to be focused on instead of something that really is already in the law. We spend somewhere between $350 and $400 million every year with states. USDA, in essence, sends checks to states for the sole purpose of doing a better job of linking work opportunities with people who are on SNAP. The theory being that states have workforce development offices. They know where the jobs are being created. And they have human service offices who's on SNAP. They administer the SNAP program. So our theory is we give a little money so that folks can just walk down the hall and visit with each other. And the workforce development folks can say, here are 50 jobs in this county. And the human services folks can say, well, geez, here's 20 people on SNAP in that county. Let's get them to work. That doesn't happen very often. Very few states do a very good job of that. And so what we ought to be focused on in this debate, if we're really serious about reducing SNAP costs the right way, is we ought to be demanding a little bit more for the money we pay. And that's on us, and it's on the states. That would be a positive opportunity for us to do the right thing in SNAP. See, are there efficiencies? Sure. But I will tell you, a $40 billion cut a $20 billion cut is just not going to happen. And I would also say that farmers need to understand that that SNAP program is as much about them as it is about the struggling families who get SNAP. Because 15 cents of every food dollar that works its way through the supply chain ends up ultimately in a farmer's income. If you think about it, people buy more at the grocery store, they buy more. They buy more, more has to be packaged, processed, shipped, trucked, refrigerated. All those are jobs in the supply chain, but eventually it means more has to be produced. And that benefits the farmer. So it is part of the safety net. It's part of the way in which we stabilize markets. So you see, this bill is not siloed. It's a bill for all of America. And everyone benefits from the various component parts of a farm bill. And if our friends in Congress will understand that, then I think we will get ultimately to the passage of a farm bill. I will say that the four leaders, two Democrats, two Republicans, House and Senate, have been meeting and are doing a good job of trying to get to a place where we have a bill. Chairman Lucas and Chairwoman Stabenow have done an extraordinary job to get us to this point under very difficult circumstances. And they have two good ranking members in Senator Cochran and Representative Peterson. And those four folks are working together. They want to get to yes. And we're helping them with technical assistance and advice and counsel from USDA. We need to get to yes. We need a budget, we need a farm bill, and we need comprehensive immigration reform. And if we get those three things, then I think there's unlimited possibilities for American agriculture to continue its forward movement, continue to have record exports, continue to have record income, continue to be engaged in record amounts of conservation, continue to expand local and regional food systems that allow smaller producers to get in the game, and continue to revitalize and change the rural economy and the entire American economy by developing a bio-based economy where we move away from our over-reliance on fossil fuels and imported oil to a place where we're creating jobs in America using a bio-based manufacturing opportunity. So I'm excited about the future. The next 35 to 40 days is going to be very important, and we're going to continue to work hard to get this farm bill because, as I said, all of America needs it. So let me stop there and open up to questions.
Please, we have microphones on either side of the room. Are they active? I'm not sure.
This is an organized effort here.
Yes, we try to be.
Okay.
For 7 years, we try to get things organized. So please come to either side of the room. Please state your name and where you are from so the secretary knows your state. And pose one question, if you would, at a time. Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, Mike Hergert, Red River Farm Network in Grand Forks. Assuming Congress can come together and reach a compromise, can you think of any reason why the White House would threaten a veto?
No, because I think that the House and Senate will understand that there are acceptable levels and unacceptable levels of various programs. Okay, so I'm assuming in your question that Democrats and Republicans on the committee, conference committee, and the leaders, Democrat and Republican, have reached a consensus, and that is our hope, and that is our wish, and that is our hope that they do it quickly. Now, the Speaker of the House says there's no connection, doesn't want any connection with the budget. Well, with due respect to the Speaker, there is a connection to the budget because we are now in sequester, just so everybody understands what this is. You all know that we USDA suffered a 7.5% cut across the board to our programs. Everything we basically did had to be cut by that amount. We face another 7.2% cut on January 16th unless there is a budget. Now, our department's not the only department facing a cut. The Defense Department is facing a huge cut, and that has got people worried. They're far more worried about the Defense Department than they are about our cut. They should be worried about our cut, too. But they're worried about the Defense Department, and they want to restore money to the Defense Department. But they also want to keep on the track of reducing the deficit, which means they have to figure out something somewhere else to cut to raise the money to give to the Defense Department so that their cut isn't as deep. Well, I will tell you, our discretionary budget has been cut to the point where it's $1 billion less than when I became secretary. I don't know if there's any secretary of agriculture that's had to go through that in recent history. I will tell you that 50% of my discretionary budget is in four areas: food safety, fire suppression, WIC, and rental assistance. All four of those things have either been at or above where they were last year and the year before and the year before. In other words, they've been increased. So the other 50% of my budget has had to assume its share of sequester, this 50% share of sequester, and any increase. We've given it the office. We've done our part. So that means that, and every department's done that. So that means that they have to look at the mandatory programs. Well, that's Social Security, that's Medicare, that's Medicaid, or they could look at tax revenues. I may have missed it, but I have been hearing a lot of people talk about any of those things. They'll say, well, we're not going to do tax cuts and we're increases and we're not going to touch Social Security and we're not going to. But you know what they have talked about? Are the farm programs. And by farm programs, I mean SNAP and the Farm Safety Net. And they know that direct payments are going. And they know there will be some savings from that. So they may need that savings, whether the Speaker wants it or not, to be able to get to a budget. And if we don't get to a budget, then we're back in the soup again that we were in just a couple weeks ago, where I was in the big, huge USDA building with 29 other people, and the other 8,000 folks were at home. We don't want that again, I hope. So, you know, I think we want to get to yes.
Mr. Secretary, Ken Rubin, the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network, from the second largest agricultural state in America.
Ken,
you've been there.
Ken, be careful with that. Is there anybody from Texas here? Okay.
I was talking income.
Oh, okay.
You said we jump on the numbers on the renewable fuel standard, and one of them kind of jumps out, and you actually were there when and signed an agreement for USDA assistance with DuPont to be able to bring a system on, a company, a plant online. And they themselves next year could produce 20 million gallons, and there's only 18 million gallons of cellulose ethanol to 30 million in this entire piece. And we have another plant there that could do the same. Do you think that number is realistic that they're putting forward on cellulosic ethanol for next year?
Ken, I don't know that that plant that DuPont's working on is at a stage where they're going to be producing at maximum production. In fact, I talked to folks from DuPont yesterday who said that they were basically, they're one crop, they need another crop before they get to a point. So they need the 14 crop before they get to full production, so that gets us into 15. And that gets me back to the point I tried to make, which is we're very concerned about 15, we should be, and we're encouraging the industry to come to us and say, okay, we don't like what you're doing here, but you've asked for comments about how we can grow this industry. Well, here are several policies that you should consider. Distribution is one of them. And the industry, I think, has to accelerate the development of these advanced and cellulosic fuels. We should have been further along than we are on this. I think everybody acknowledges that. It's been kind of slow. So hopefully this is a wake-up call. And I think, frankly, you also have to recognize the political reality surrounding the RFS. The petroleum industry has gone after this RFS in a big way. They want to get rid of it. They want to get rid of it. They don't want to amend it. They don't want to change it. They want to get rid of it. All right? So they've gone to Congress, and they have some people in Congress, a lot more than they had a year ago, a lot more than they had 2 years ago, a lot more than they had 4 years ago, who are thinking maybe this is the time to get rid of it. So we've got to maintain that RFS, and we have to mute and mitigate the pushback by the petroleum industry, and we've got to accelerate this advanced biofuel production, and we've got to figure out how to get this distribution wider than just the state of Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota. All three states have done a great job. Terrific. But you know what? It's got to be in the other 47 states in the same way it is in Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, some of those other Midwestern states. That's my point. That's what I can control. You know, I don't know what the science and the math is behind all those numbers. What I do know is this. What I can control is this distribution issue to the extent I have programs in place if the Farm Bill gets passed. I want to help, and we need to know what kind of help we can provide. You know, we'll wait for the next question. One of the other things in this farm bill that is important is the fact that it does contain some, I see these young people here, it does contain some very interesting new opportunities to expand help for beginning farmers, women farmers, and veterans, returning veterans. And that's extremely important to us at USDA because, you know, we're a bit concerned about the aging nature of some of our farm families. We want to make sure that there is a pipeline of young people getting into this business. And as Congress starts thinking about tax reform, they ought to be thinking about a different tax than is normally discussed at venues like this. Normally, I will get a question if I'm at a farm meeting about the estate tax. ERS just did a study about the estate tax. And what they found was that 0.6% of farmers, that's not 6%, that's 0.6%, 0.6% of farmers would pay estate tax. 0.6% of farmers would pay estate tax. What we don't talk about and what we should talk about is the income tax. Because if you've held a farm for a period of time, you've seen an appreciation in the value of that farm. And you have no incentive to get rid of that farm, to sell that farm, to transfer that farm, because if you die, your heirs get a stepped-up basis and they pay no income tax if they sell it. And apparently, 99.4% don't pay any estate tax either. So we ought to be talking about ways in which we can use the income tax system to encourage folks who have no children, who have no heirs, or have folks who are not interested in farming, to be able to transfer that land, not incur income tax liability, to a returning veteran, to a beginning farmer, to someone who wants to get in the business. That's got to be a focus, and we've got to start changing the conversation about taxes and farming, because right now the focus is entirely on the estate tax. That impacts such a small percentage. But this income tax, I guarantee you there are a lot of people out there with farms, and we're seeing a lot of absentee landowners. You know, that land ought to be made available to young people, ought to be made available to returning veterans. But there's no incentive to do it. Who's next? Sorry.
Question, Mr. Secretary. All five of the state secretaries in our previous session all mentioned water issues and food security. With the reduced budget that you've already stated, and many times out of the hands of the Department of Agriculture in the state or the U.S. Department of Agriculture, your comments for these states that use irrigation, Nebraska, Kansas, and all of others, and other states for water issues for the rural and urban areas, your thoughts on water and food security?
Well, first of all, I'd point out that I don't know what the situation is in Louisiana, but North Dakota, Nebraska, and California all have budget surpluses at the state level. Is that right, Secretary?
That's because I gave so much at the office.
I understand. So these states are flush. I just would point that out. Seriously, critically important question, and I think it starts with our understanding and appreciation that we have got to have strategies that will allow us to adapt and mitigate to a changing climate, because it's been the hottest decade on record, one of the hottest years ever. And if you look long-term, 30, 40 years down the road, what you will see is projections that the growing seasons in parts of our country will change. And what can be grown in those parts of the country will potentially also change. And it will migrate north. And we don't necessarily want that to happen. We'd like to be able to maintain the great diversity that we have in this country, and we'd like to be able to adapt and mitigate so that regardless of what Mother Nature does, we're at least working with her or one step ahead of her, which is why we established and are establishing climate change hubs that are regional, that are going to look at crops that are grown in each region of the country. They're going to ask the question, how does a changing climate impact and affect those crops, and what can we do now, right now, to equip producers to be able to mitigate the consequences of that. Secondly, we know the important role that conservation plays in soil health and in retaining precious water. We saw the consequences of that in part last year with the drought, despite the worst drought in 80 years, we still had, by some standards, the fifth and by others, the eighth largest corn crop in the history of the country. Part of that was because of the conservation practices that farmers were utilizing that allowed moisture to be retained, precious moisture could be retained. We need to encourage more conservation. But the fact that we have less money doesn't necessarily mean that we will have less conservation. Here's why. We're developing ways in which we can attract private sector investment in conservation. We know that as we get better at quantifying and measuring and verifying the result of a conservation practice, we can essentially sell that result to a regulated industry that needs that conservation result to satisfy some regulatory responsibility it has. It may be a water treatment facility that basically pays farmers to conserve so that certain contaminants don't get in the water to begin with. It may be a power company that needs water, as is the case in the northwestern part of the country, where they take water out of a stream, use it to produce power, put it back in the stream. It's a little bit warmer. Salmon don't like the warm water, so they have to build a cooling tower. But instead of investing in the gray infrastructure of a cooling tower that costs millions of dollars, someone was smart enough to figure out if you pay adjoining landowners along that stream to plant shade trees, the water temperature goes down, salmon are happy, company saves money, landowners, new income source to invest in conservation. So these ecosystem markets, we've invested in 60 different local ecosystem markets with our Conservation Innovation Grant program, are a way of attracting private sector investment. And as we learn more about carbon and carbon sequestration and power plants are faced with some serious challenges in connection with carbon, private working lands will be a place where carbon can be sequestered. It's why you're beginning to see an expanded use of cover crops. It's why we have this soil health campaign that's focused on cover crops and proper nutrient management and crop residue with appropriate levels of crop residue to replenish the soil. So there is a concerted effort here to mitigate the consequences of climate change, to establish best practices, to attract additional resources into conservation, and to create incentives for folks to invest their own money in conservation by providing some greater certainty that if they make the investment, the rules aren't going to change on them. And this is now being used with a partnership we have with the Department of Interior involving seven species that could potentially be listed in the endangered species list, lesser prairie chicken, sage grouse, bog turtle, and other critters that could potentially be listed. And if they're listed, that could create some serious financial consequences for landowners. So we've gone to those landowners and we've said, look, if you invest in conservation practices, and we at NRCS will help you with money to do so, the Department of Interior will give you 30 years of assurance that if that critter is listed at any point in time, you will have already been deemed in compliance. So you don't have to worry about additional responsibilities. And we're seeing great acceptance of that, particularly with the sage grouse in the western part of the country. So we are we're investing in that effort. The third answer is a continued investment in research. And that's why it's important to get a farm bill passed. Not only will this farm bill streamline conservation, make those conservation programs a little easier, and maybe allow us to build on the programs that we have in place. We just announced the Comet Farm program, which basically allows producers to be able to quantify precisely what that conservation benefit is on their farm. So as we create these ecosystem markets, they'll be able to market that result. But we also have the possibility of creating a research foundation. Right now, healthcare has all this money going into it because they've got a foundation that attracts and leverages additional resources. We don't have that tool at USDA. The Senate passed Farm Bill creates a research foundation that would allow us to leverage additional money and to expand the amount of money that we have available for research. And that research is going to be critically important in terms of figuring out how to protect crops, how to protect livestock, how to increase productivity. And that information, obviously, once we have it, can be shared with others around the world to ensure that their agriculture is as productive as it needs to be as well. So investments in research. The fourth thing we need to do on a regulatory side is to make sure that as new technologies are advanced, that they get into the marketplace after careful study, but without undue delay. I'm proud to say that in this administration, we have knocked off 330 days of the review process for biotechnology crops, and we are very close to basically knocking in half the amount of time it used to take to get approvals. We're going to continue to focus on process improvement to cut that time down. And the last thing is that we want other countries to be productive. We don't feel threatened by that because we face this enormous challenge. 9 billion people got to increase agricultural production globally by 70%. It's going to require more innovation than we've had in the next 40 years than we've had in the preceding 10,000 years, I'm told. So we want folks to step up their game, because when they step up their game, the middle classes are developed in their countries, and those middle classes have a great desire for what we can produce in terms of protein. So it helps a resurgence of the livestock industry. So we are very much engaged in all of that. And we also recognize the important role that forests play in water preservation and conservation. So we have a major effort at restoring our forests and trying to figure out ways in which we can fund fires differently than we fund them today. Because fires, unlike tornadoes or floods or, you know, hurricanes, when that happens, there's a pot of money set aside, doesn't come out of the operating budget of the Department of Homeland Security or FEMA. Sort of a set aside, it's an emergency fund. We don't have that. Lightning strikes, we got 100,000 acres burning up, and we got communities at risk. We got to fight that fire, but it comes out of the overall budget of the fire service or the Forest Service, and when it comes out, we sometimes have to rob Peter to pay Paul, which makes it that we don't have enough money to do the restoration work that would do a better job of conserving and preserving water. So lots of activity in this space, and we're very, very, very concerned about it.
Michelle Rook, WNAX in Yankton, South Dakota. Can you explain how the EPA decision, how EPA can actually set the volumetric requirements for the ethanol mandate lower than what is required by law?
I will try to do that. I'm not the EPA administrator, and I have a hard enough time operating my own department without operating hers, but I will try. The law does provide for the ability to waive the statutorily designed volume requirements. So EPA is using their waiver authority to reduce the numbers. They would say the reason they are reducing the numbers is that we are at a point where the amount of fuel being consumed in this country is roughly 130 billion gallons. Because there's so little distribution of higher blends of ethanol, most places are only selling E10. So basically 10% of the fuel supply is ethanol. So 10% of 130 billion gallons is 13 billion gallons. So that's why distribution becomes so important. If you had higher percentages of ethanol available and people were using more E85 or E15 or E30, then we wouldn't have this issue. Because the oil industry's done a pretty good job of making it hard to get those distribution systems in place, we're kind of stuck. The other thing is, when those numbers were set, those volume numbers were set, you'll notice that they were increasing every year. They were based on the assumption that Americans would consume each and every year more and more gas as a general proposition. Well, with fuel-efficient vehicles and with unemployment rate over 7%, less gas is being consumed than was anticipated. In fact, we actually have reduced the amount of gas that we are using in this country because we now have cars that get, 30, 40 miles per gallon. So the assumption upon which the RFS was based turns out not to be correct, that we were going to continue to see increases. We've actually seen a decrease. So when you combine the decrease with the lack of availability of E85 and E15, you basically bump up against just the math of it. That's why it's important, and that's why the EPA went the extra mile of saying, hey, we've got to figure out how to get more higher blends in the marketplace. Give us your ideas. Tell us what we need to do. Tell us what policies might work, because we are absolutely facing a resistance by the oil industry to make that happen. You go to an oil company and they'll say, well, we don't own the gas stations anymore. We can't tell those gas station folks. But they'll whisper to the gas station, well, you don't want to put those pumping systems in because there's a liability there. And then you got some of the car companies going, oh, my gosh, we don't, you know, it's going to hurt your engine and you're going to have a warranty issue. So there's been a whispering campaign. You know, if you've seen the ad, I don't know if it's up in your neck of the woods, but of the mechanic who's under the car who says, you know, if you use ethanol, you're going to be coming in and I'll be fixing your car. Don't use a higher blend. I mean, there's literally TV ads to that effect. So it's a concerted effort. So the key here, I think, is for us to figure out strategies to go around the oil industry. And it may require some of the bigger outfits like a Cargill or an ADM getting in the business of selling gas or figuring out how to partner with convenience store operators to encourage higher blends. That's the best I can do.
Thank you.
Yeah. Gina McCarthy could do no doubt a better job, but that's the best I can do.
Rob Winters, WoWo Radio. I know it's not your department, so we're asking you again to run somebody else's department here, but there is so much that is produced here in the Midwest, in the Grain Belt, that moves up and down the river system. You know that that's been a huge problem. I know that's the transportation department, but is there any leverage that you can affect over that issue to hopefully get some kind of a solution about where we're headed with our waterway system?
Well, there's a bill in Congress that passed both the House and the Senate, different versions, a water bill that would provide resources for the Army Corps to improve the waterways of this country. And so, frankly, the power to do that actually is in this room by encouraging members of Congress to get the conference committee started, and the conferees were just appointed, to get those conferees in a room and work out the differences and get that done so that the Army Corps has a long-term set of resources and a certainty about what those resources are so that they can plan accordingly. We did, and Colleen can attest to this, we did engage in encouraging the Army Corps when it looked like we might not have enough water flowing down the Mississippi late last year. We encouraged them, and I used my position as the chair of the Rural Council to encourage them to go out and blast those rocks up so that there was so we didn't see a significant disruption or stoppage of traffic. So I have an advocacy role and an education role about the impact, and we basically explained to folks the economic impact that that would have. So we'll continue that advocacy, but right now the key is getting Congress to finish the water bill, finish the farm bill, finish the immigration bill, and get a budget, or any one of those four.
One more question. I hear some, Dave Dickey from Illinois Public Media, I hear some frustration in your voice about any one of those four. Just pick one. And I know there's 14 legislation days left this year. And I know a few weeks ago 41 speeches were given, and while there was some bipartisanship expressed, there are still issues beyond SNAP that are complex and need an attention. And I know all about the budget issues that you spoke of earlier as a piece of it, too. And I'm very pragmatic, and producers I serve are very pragmatic. So I suppose the question at the end of the day that they will want to know from you is, under what timeline do you think a farm bill will actually emerge?
Okay.
And in when might the president be, and you be in the Oval Office signing together?
Okay. Well, you're absolutely right. There are other issues. COOL is an issue. Dairy is an issue. The King Amendment is a big issue. You can't have, in my view, you can't have 50 different variations of you know, I think that there has to be some kind of continuity there. The catfish issue, the cotton issue, there are lots of issues, okay? But I think there is a desire on the part of the leaders of the conference committee to work through all those issues and to get it done. That is really important. First was to get a conference committee, which it took far too long to get that done, but we finally got it done. And now it's the leaders, getting the leaders in a room. They weren't meeting, so I picked up the phone and I said, hey, guys, you got to get in the room. You're not going to get it done unless you start talking to each other. So they're talking to each other, and they're making progress. And their focus has initially been on the commodity title because that's where some significant differences were. And my guess is the last thing they're going to resolve is probably the SNAP issue, but everything else in between, staff's working on. And we're helping with technical assistance and constructive ideas as to how you might be able to bridge the gap. You ask, when could this happen? Well, there are some key dates here. December 15th is a key date because that's the date upon which the Budget Committee is supposed to report to the Congress their fix for the 2014 fiscal year budget. It seems to me as if they would like to know where the Farm Bill discussions are prior to December 15th. And that would encourage producers or the conference committee to get something reasonably concrete around the Thanksgiving holiday or shortly thereafter. The next big date is January 15th, because that's the date upon which the Congress is supposed to pass whatever the budget committee comes up with so that we have a budget. We don't have another shutdown. So it's conceivable that if this is going to get done, sometime between now and the end of the year, you would expect and anticipate that we'd have a farm bill. That would be my hope. Now, we've been disappointed before, right? But that would be my hope. And I think there is the desire on the part of everybody in the process to get it done. You hear the Speaker say it, you hear Majority Leader Reid say it, you hear the President talk about it, and you hear the leaders of the conference committee talk about it. So I think we're in a different place than we've been for the last 2.5 years when I've been talking about this. I sincerely hope the next time I come to this meeting that we're talking about, you're probably complaining about the fact we're not implementing it fast enough. Because we've been having this conversation for 3 years. It's crazy. The next key date is January 16th, because if they don't get a budget done before January 16th, or if they get some kind of continuing resolution in place, the sequester, that 7.2% cut, that goes into effect. And then the next date is February 7th, because that's the date that the debt ceiling gets reached again. And they're going to have to make a decision about what to do about that. So there's a lot of need for decisions to be made. And that gets me back to the comment I made earlier about this whole notion of silos. Look, folks, somebody in the process has to look at the larger overall picture here. And they have to recognize that absent a farm bill, you have Brazil that can retaliate against our products under the cotton case. You have permanent law potentially going into place at the end of the year and creating havoc in the market. And you lose all the benefits, the job creation benefits, the research benefits and innovation benefits, the conservation benefits, the trade promotion benefits, and the safety net for whether it's farmers or for struggling families. You lose all of that by not having a farm bill. So if you look at the totality of the need and the importance that the Farm Bill plays in all of Americans' lives, it seems to me that that would be compelling for people to say, you know what, I'm going to give a little bit on this thing that I feel strongly about because my colleague over here is going to give a little bit on something he or she feels strongly about. We got to get back in the business of giving and getting instead of this notion that it's my way or the highway. That's not how small towns work. I was a mayor of a small town for 5 years. That was not the way the city council worked. You know, we had differences, but we worked them out. I was in the state legislature with a Republican governor. We got things done. I was a governor with a Republican legislature. We got things done. So there's no reason this can't be done. And I think the fact that people expressed disappointment in the way in which the shutdown occurred and were pretty frustrated by it, hopefully that memory is still there. And the last thing I would say is this. There's also, I think, an extraordinary benefit that could occur to the system by getting a farm bill done. You know, I think deep down inside in the DNA of Congress, there is the ability to get things done. It just hasn't been utilized for a while. And they need to experience success. They need to get a bill done and have people go, wow, this is great. We finally got a farm bill. And they say, thanks very much. Congratulations. And all of a sudden they go, it works. And they get reminded that it feels good to do something. It doesn't feel good to fight, to conflict, to always be at each other's throats. It feels a lot better when you got a product that you can be proud of. And this farm bill, as they work through it, has the potential for being something they can be genuinely proud of. It's a reform bill. It's an innovation bill. It's a trade bill. It's a jobs bill. It's an energy bill. It's a conservation bill. It's a safety net bill. It's a food security bill. And it benefits all of America. You know, what's not to like about that? So, you know, we're going to keep plugging and keep encouraging folks to get it done. And, you know, if it takes an extra legislative day, then maybe they stick around for a day. Or maybe, shucks, maybe they work on Saturday. Or Friday. You know, so that's how I'd answer that question. So thank you all very much.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Another nice hand for an NAFB welcome, and a thank you to Mr. Secretary of Agriculture.